pieces of the power spectrum. Okay. So then you can crack open the papers from Planck and look at what they have and the parameters they constrain and have some fairly good intuitive understanding of what all those things mean. So to get through the few things we have left before then, I'll just recap the most important parts of the last lecture. So we discussed scales in cosmology, and an important scale was the co-moving horizon, because this tells you when gradients are important, effectively. So if I have waves in the metric or dark matter or anything else, then we saw yesterday that evolution becomes important when k is much less than ah. That is when the modes become sub-horizon, okay? So they become of a co-moving scale that's less than the co-moving horizon. If they're of a co-moving scale less than that of the co-moving horizon, then they're of a physical scale less than that of the physical horizon, okay? So this is when peaks come into causal contact with troughs, okay, effectively. And then modes can start evolving and doing interesting things like growing and forming galaxies and structure and all the nice things that we see in the universe around us today. So here's a little plot of co-moving scale versus conformal time. So remember that in the radiation era, 1 over ah, the co-moving horizon, is just eta. I need to be more careful about my microscopic handwriting. 1 over ah is eta. And if I have a k-mode of some fixed co-moving scale, so that's just some k, then at early times, it's super horizon, so the co-moving scale is just bigger than that of the co-moving horizon. But you can see that 1 over ah is growing during the radiation era. And eventually, we get to the matter era, where we showed that the co-moving horizon still grows linearly with eta, but it goes like eta over 2. So this constant co-moving scale becomes more and more relevant when compared to the co-moving horizon until we get to the point where it's equal. That's a moment known as horizon crossing. We'll probably use that terminology quite a bit in the second half of this course. And then eventually things become superhorizon, okay? A subhorizon, and then they can start evolving and you get structure and yada, yada, yada. So the thing that we derived Friday, was deep in the radiation era on superhorizon scales, the Boltzmann equations, the equations governing the temperature of photons, the dark matter density, velocities, and all the higher moments of the temperature field. On superhorizon scales, we found this extremely simple solution, which was that the zeroth moment of the temperature field is related to the initial value of the potential over 2, and the dark matter density perturbations at that initial epoch was equal to 3/2 times that initial potential perturbation, right? And velocities were about 0 because we showed that they decay, and all these higher moments were 0. The reason that all of the higher moments of the photon field are 0 is because if I look deep in the radiation era, the mean free path of photons is just 1 over the number density of electrons times the cross-section to scatter times A. That's just basically the rate that I'm scattering off photons off electrons effectively. And so what that means is that if I'm some observer in the really early universe deep in the radiation era, then these photons are going to be scattering and scattering and scattering, and the only time that I can consistently get photons from some sphere that surrounds me is if the size of that sphere is less than or about equal to the mean free path of these photons, right? So since that is really small, if I compare that to the average size of the wavelength of fluctuations at this time, unless fluctuations are incredibly tiny scale, less than or equal to the mean free path of photons, then to me it just looks like I have an almost constant temperature distribution across my sky, right? I just see the same number of photons with the same temperature coming at me from all directions, effectively. So that's why we only kept the zeroth moment of the temperature distribution function, right? Because that's just the average temperature seen by someone across their sky. So are there any questions on this stuff from yesterday, from Friday, which also, I guess, is wrapped up a lot with the types of questions that I was asking in the homework assignment? Okay. So let's examine this a little bit in more detail, and let's ask about corrections to this. So what happens when I don't necessarily assume that things are occurring on superhorizon scales, but I just want to solve for the full evolution of these moments of the temperature distribution function, the dark matter densities, velocities, et cetera, in the radiation era? So let's unpack this a little bit more. So the physical distance that photons are going to travel between scatterings is just basically this mean free path, but let's talk about a physical distance. So lambda mean free path, we're talking about a physical distance. This is going to be 1 over the number density of electrons times the scattering cross-section. So in a Hubble time, so that's the scale, the time scale characterizing the expansion of the universe. If interactions are happening much slower than 1 per Hubble time, then I'm basically not interacting with anything, right? So this is the relevant time scale to compare things on. So in a Hubble time, the number of scatters is going to go like this mean free path, 1 over the mean free path, because that gives me something like a rate, times h inverse. So this will be h inverse lambda mean free path, physical 1 over that. And so you can imagine these photons just sort of bouncing off of the electrons more or less in a random walk, okay? So their direction after scattering off of any given electron is just, well, it's like it's random, so this is just some random walk. There's some probability that I come out at different angles. So at a random walk, the average distance that your photon is going to travel, we'll call that lambda d, in a Hubble time is going to basically be this mean free path times root n, because the distance that I move in a random walk is the length of each leg times the square root of the number of steps that I take. So this is the average distance that photons can travel in a Hubble time. And this is an important scale because any perturbations that I have, which are on a scale smaller than this, are just going to end up getting washed out. So these photons, if they can efficiently scatter off of all of these electrons and sort of travel, then any initial temperature anisotropy that I have, or any difference in temperature that I have here, will just end up getting totally washed out after a Hubble time. So this defines a damping scale. And any fluctuations that are on a scale less than this will just be washed out. So if we translate that into k, that means that any k
since we're talking about k co-moving, I have to stick a factor of a back in over 1 times a lambda d will be totally washed out. So actually now, if we come back here, so if I had fluctuations that were on a scale sort of inside of this last scattering surface, so smaller than the part that, that I get to see, then that scale is basically equal to the damping scale, or it's fairly close. So even if I did have these really small wavelength fluctuations, I wouldn't be able to see them anyways because they'd be totally damped out. And so that's more support for this argument that deep in the radiation era, all of these higher moments of the photon distribution function just don't matter. Okay. So now we can be a little bit more careful. We can actually estimate, well, what is the first correction? Like, what would theta 1 be? So let's return to our set of equations that we had, which we wrote down on Thursday, which was the most general set of equations that I claim we need to understand fluctuations in the universe. And in particular, we had this equation for the temperature field, which looked like this. Yeah, that was it there. So that's the equation for the temperature field. And as you'll show in the homework, the way that you can get equations for the moments of the temperature field is to take this whole equation, multiply it or integrate it over mu times these Legendre polynomials. So if we take this whole equation and integrate that, then d mu pl times theta, you'll recall that theta l is proportional to d mu over 2 pl times theta. So we're just going to pick out the various moments of this distribution function. And whenever I have mu times theta, you can use the recursion relation for these Legendre polynomials, which you'll show in the homework, to turn that into an equation for a Legendre polynomial of an order one less, say, or some combination of one less and one more. And wherever I have a mu, I know that P1 is, I think that's actually, it's just not even proportional. What is that? It's like 3 mu minus 1 over 2 or something like that, right? So P1 is related to mu. So you can see anywhere I have a mu, I'm going to pick out the first moment, right? So that just has the L equals 1 piece. OK, so if I do that, what you'll find is that we have an equation of motion for theta 0 dot, which has some k theta 1 that came from here. So I pick out this piece. From this recursion relation. And then on the right-hand side, I've got negative phi dot. Okay, that came here because there's no mu, so this just gets hit with p0, and anything else, it will die. And I also get an equation for theta 1, so theta 1 dot gives me this piece. So again, this came from this term applying the recursion relation for Legendre polynomials, which you'll do in the homework. And this is equal to now k psi over 3. That came from this piece here because I'm going to pick out a component from P1.
And then I've got this piece here, which has to do with scattering. So the integral over theta 0 gives me nothing. And then I'll have this theta and then a VB piece there. Okay, so these are the equations for the first two moments of the temperature distribution function. Okay, so we also have equations for the overdensities in dark matter and baryons. And those, you'll recall, just quoting what we had from before, for baryons, for example, is given by the following. And then we have an equation of motion for V dot for the baryons. That's A dot over A, VB. And then I'll have similar equations for the overdensity in dark matter and in the velocity of the dark matter distribution. So that's A dot over A, V equals, IKV, negative 3 phi dot. And then an equation for the dark matter velocity distribution, which is A dot over A, V. And dark matter doesn't interact with photons, so I don't get that term on the right-hand side. Okay, so this is what we need. If we want to solve for this plus Einstein's equation is what we need, and if we want to solve for all the moments of the distribution function, et cetera, et cetera. So let's now ask about this theta 1 piece and the velocity of the baryons. So we can rewrite this equation here as follows. So VB is equal to negative 3i theta 1 plus r over tau dot vb dot plus a dot over a vb plus ik psi. And this thing here, remember, was inversely proportional to the number density of electrons. So if I go to an early enough time, then this is just going to end up getting extremely large, okay? So in particular, I can just throw away this term if I go to early enough times. So then that tells me that VB is approximately equal to negative 3i theta 1. And that's going to be a good approximation until tau dot becomes small enough, right? And then these other terms are going to start to matter. But early enough on, this is what I get. And this approximation here is known as tight coupling. So the velocity perturbations and hence the density perturbations in the baryons are going to be extremely tightly coupled to what's going on with the photons, yeah, and through this first term. So I can't exactly throw away theta 1. It's going to be smaller than theta naught, but I can't exactly throw it away because it's going to determine what's going to be going on here with the baryons. So let's keep that one around. So now what we can do is use this to eliminate VB in this equation. And correspondingly, I can look at these guys, shuffle some things around. So first, we're going to eliminate VB in favor of theta 1 everywhere we can. The second thing we can do is take the conformal time derivative of my equation for theta 0 dot. And the third thing we can do is use the equation for theta 1 and theta 1 dot to get an equation just for theta naught. So if you chug through the algebra, which I encourage you to do, eliminate V1 in favor of theta naught using this equation, take the conformal time derivative of this thing, so I get a second order equation for theta naught, and then use these equations to eliminate theta 1 and theta 1 dot, then you will get the following. Where there are going to be a few definitions in here that I will give you in a second. So you'll recall that R was just three rho baryon over 4 rho gamma, I believe. Or did I get that upside down? And the sound speed here is just defined as 1 over square root 3, 1 plus r. So let's think about what this equation tells us. So if I didn't have any baryons, I just had photons, then this equation will be very reminiscent of what you did in tutorial if I just had a perfect fluid where the pressure was determined by one-third rho, right? So here, the sound speed comes from the fact that photons have an intrinsic pressure. If I have a fluid of photons, then they carry a pressure. And what the presence of baryons do is it takes that and it modifies it a little bit, because now these baryons are not completely pressureless because they're interacting with the photons, right? So they're going to take this sound speed, which is associated with the pressure of our perfect fluid, and alter it a little bit from what we expect for photons. So that's why we get this 1 over root 3, 1 plus r. So we've got this equation. Another thing to note is that performing this algebraic trick here, we always have theta coming in combination with the gravitational potential phi. So this is some second order equation. It's going to have, you can guess, oscillatory-like solutions. And those solutions will be oscillatory in this combination. So this combination of things will be oscillatory, okay, theta naught plus phi. So again, drawing from what you did in tutorial for a very similar looking equation, we're slowly varying speeds of sound. So this is varying in time because radiation and matter redshift with different factors of A. So the sound speed is going to be changing with time. So for slowly varying sound speed, then this solution, at least to the homogeneous equation,
That doesn't mean homogeneous universe. That means neglecting the forcing term on the right-hand side, just for clarity. And if we forget about this damping for a second, so for slowly varying sound speed, the solution to the homogeneous part of the equation, for theta naught plus phi, is just going to be a sum of a sine and a cosine. Where the sound speed, or sound horizon, excuse me, you'll recall, is just defined as this integral from 0 to eta of the sound speed. So for a constant sound speed, then this would just be CS times eta, right? Just what we'd expect. That's just the comoving distance that something moving at a constant speed would have traveled in a time eta. Okay. So we can now plug back this equation and using some tricks figure out what the most general possible solution would be. So first of all, to note, we're assuming here a particular set of initial conditions, right? So we know that deep in the radiation era on these superhorizon scales, if I just had a constant potential perturbation, remember there was a growing a constant mode and a decaying mode, and if I just keep the constant mode, then I got these relations. So in particular, if I had a constant mode at early times, then I am going to pick out the cosine piece and not the sine piece. If I had the sine, that means I have some initial velocity for theta naught. But under these assumptions here, I don't. So let's throw the sine piece away and just keep the cosine. That's from an assumption on the initial conditions. So if I add my forcing term back in, then this is going to go to the following most general solution. Which now involves the terms that I had over here from the forcing. Okay. So you can argue to yourself that the damping term on the time scales that we're talking about is just simply not going to be important because R is fairly slowly varying compared to the time scales that we're interested in for Ks that are subhorizon. Okay. So on subhorizon scales, this damping term basically doesn't play a huge role. And so we effectively get this sinusoidal or cosine oscillation. And then I have to compensate a little bit for the fact that I have these forcing terms. Okay. So what that means is that we have these oscillations in this combination as a function of conformal time. And so if I fix the conformal time, then you're going to get peaks in the amplitude of this thing whenever k is equal to n pi over sound horizon, where n is 1, 2, 3, et cetera, an integer. Okay. And these are the baryon acoustic oscillations.
So if you were to plot what was going on and we fix eta at some time, then you're going to have some some integer frequencies which peak at this particular conformal time that we've chosen, right? So I'm just slicing all of these sines and cosines at a given value of eta. Okay, extremely important fact about the universe. If I have baryons, then I have acoustic oscillations with a very characteristic scale. Okay. So if this eta is, say, the time at which basically my photons from the CMB just free stream and reach me, then this scale is gonna show up, right? That's gonna be something that we can probe. So qualitatively, now we can sort of unpack this a bit. So first of all, let's ask maybe what this forcing term does. So if I had some equation of motion for a point particle, so let's say I just had a spring coupled to a constant force. Then the solution to this equation for a constant force would just be that x is, again, our cosine. So we'd have cosine omega t plus f naught over m omega squared. So all the presence of a constant force does in a second order equation of motion, say for this spring, is to take the oscillations . So if I didn't have this forcing term, I'd just have something that was distributed around x equals 0. So all the forcing term does is to take that and raise it up. So it changes the 0 point of the oscillations. And low frequency waves get the biggest displacement for these oscillations. Okay, so the way to make this displacement large is to look at stuff that's happening at low frequencies. So now if I looked at x squared versus t, x squared will be relevant in a moment because we'll want to talk about the power spectrum, which depends on the square of these guys. So x squared will now be shifted because now I have this displacement from 0. So in particular, what you'll find is that the odd peaks are higher than the even ones. So this is an important fact that will be useful momentarily. Okay, so now I've told you what happens qualitatively and somewhat quantitatively, at least, with the photon field and the metric. So let's go back and think about what happens with the baryons and the dark matter. So again, roughly qualitatively, let's say initially, it's just true that the overdensities in all of these quantities are related by our assumption of the initial conditions.
So that means that theta naught, phi, and delta are all correlated. So if I have an overdensity in the photons, I also have an overdensity in the dark matter. So let's now take a number of time slices. So here, this is some box at t equals 0. And let's say I have some initial overdensity in all of these quantities here. So the universe evolves. Eventually, this overdensity becomes subhorizon. And then interesting things can start to happen, so it can start evolving. And because it's an overdensity, and because the baryons are tightly coupled to the photons, then this overdensity has got some pressure, so it's going to want to explode. So if we look at some later time, then what would have happened is I get this outgoing shell of baryons and photons. But in the meantime, my dark matter doesn't want to do anything because it only couples indirectly. If we look at this equation here for the dark matter, well, delta doesn't really depend on what's going on with the photons or what's going on with the baryons. It only feels them indirectly through the gravitational potential. While these baryons and photons are moving out, you know, at roughly 1 over square root 3 times the speed of light. So this is happening on a fairly quick time scale. This thing really explodes. So this is moving out. I get this expanding shell of baryons and photons. But then eventually what happens is when these baryons now in the late universe start to decouple from the photons, so in the late universe, the importance of this coupling term, the tau dot term, is going to be less and less because that's just going away as I dilute all the baryons in my universe. That's just going like the number density of electrons, and that's dropping like 1 over the scale factor cubed. So eventually, if we wait long enough, then these photons will now just want to stream away from this cloud of baryons. And the baryons are now going to act just like the cold dark matter, because that extra term I had on the right for the equation of V dot is just now going to become totally irrelevant because tau dot is going to 0. Yeah. And so what you're left with at late times is some shell of dark matter, or some lump of dark matter, which hasn't really had much of a chance to do anything. And then surrounding that will be some shell of baryons. And there's a very characteristic distance that these baryons can travel during that time. And that's basically just the sound horizon, right? By definition. So they move out at the speed of sound until this time eta, and they've had a chance to travel the sound horizon at whatever time these things end up decoupling, okay? Which is the time that the CMB is formed, decoupling. So now if you ask, okay, well, that was one overdensity. What if I had a whole bunch of overdensities? Then it won't look like this. This is sort of like throwing my chalk into a pond of water and then looking at the outgoing ripple. Now I'm going to have, you know, many, many, many pieces of chalk and throw them in the water, and all of these ripples will superimpose. But if I look at that pattern at any given time, there's still a characteristic scale in that pattern because all my ripples are made up of these lumps surrounded by shells of size the sound horizon. So statistically, you can look for this in the distribution of galaxies, because here you're going to have galaxies forming in this original little lump of dark matter, but also you're going to have galaxies forming in these lumps of baryons, right? So eventually you'll have galaxies that are separated on this very characteristic scale of order of the sound horizon. And so this is how you can look for baryonacoustic oscillations in galaxy surveys. So this characteristic scale shows up in the distribution of galaxies. And of course, this characteristic scale will also show up in the distribution of temperature that we see in the cosmic microwave background radiation. Because again, that characteristic scale, the sound horizon, also shows up in the solution for this particular combination of theta naught and phi. So now let's see how that happens. So remember, the way to answer this question, why we introduced this distribution function in the first place, is that the delta t over t that we see in the CMB is just this photon distribution function evaluated here and now. So what we've done so far is to calculate this distribution function, which is basically just got this monopole piece. It's just theta naught. Theta is basically equal to theta naught. And this tells us the photon distribution function at the time of recombination, or up to the time of recombination. So now all we need to do is to propagate that to here and now. Okay. So we have those equations. Those are just the coupled equations for the photon temperature and all of these things, this enormous nasty set of equations that we've been unpacking for the past half a week. And so we can do that. And we're going to do that not precisely, but we'll make another approximation so that we can make progress. By the way, you don't have to make any of these approximations. You can just sit down with a computer and really just integrate that full set of equations from the initial conditions that we have on the board to today, and then you'll get the answer. But we'd be here for much longer than 3 weeks if we wanted to go through all that. So we're going to make progress by making a certain approximation. But if you want to make a precise prediction, say, to compare your theory with Planck data, then you're not going to do this. You're going to actually use the computer and integrate these equations exactly. So what is the approximation we're going to make? Basically, is we're going to say that there is a time here where I have extremely efficient scattering of my photons off of electrons. That was this tight coupling approximation. And then almost instantaneously, we're going to say that there are no more interactions of the baryons with photons, so that at this time, photons just simply don't scatter off of anything. Okay. So these photons now can just travel freely, and then here we are today to observe them. So if they're just traveling freely, then this is called free streaming. So we're going to go from tight coupling to free streaming in an instant, okay? So that, of course, isn't really true. What really would happen is that there's this region, it's continuous, right, where we really track what's going on with tau dot with that optical depth, and then we can integrate these equations as that varies in time and figure out what the true answer is. But we'll just start by making this approximation because it'll make our life easier. So if we're down here, tight coupling basically just gives us a set of initial conditions to shove into the propagation for this part where we're free streaming. So in this approximation,
We can return to our equation for theta. So this is the full equation. We haven't taken any moments. So we've got theta is ik mu equals negative ik mu psi. Okay, so that's just the equation for theta, but I'm forgetting about the term that had to do with scattering, because I said there's no scattering. And so now if we unpack this equation a little bit, well, on the largest scales, then psi is basically a constant. So that's something you showed in your homework, or will show in your homework, or explore in your homework. So now I'm just forgetting about any interactions with photons, so everything is just dark matter and potentials, and the photons just are streaming through those potentials. And that's exactly the universe without baryons that you were studying in the homework assignment. So on the largest scales, we just have psi as a constant. So I can rewrite this equation just a little bit. So this is going to be d eta times this combination of theta and psi. So d psi d eta is 0, so all I've done is add 0 to this equation. And this has a particularly simple solution. So the solution is just, of course, oscillatory. So we get psi plus theta as a function of conformal time is going to be equal to the initial condition, so that's theta at the time of last scattering plus psi at the time of last scattering. And then I'll get an exponential e to the ik mu times eta minus eta at last scattering. Okay. So this, we already know what that is. Well, the moments of the temperature field at last scattering basically just consist of theta naught. There's theta 1 as well, but to first approximation, it's just theta naught. So this is going to go to theta naught at last scattering. And now we can again use the trick of multiplying this by Legendre polynomials and then integrating to pick out equations of motion for the moments of the temperature field. Yeah. So we can use the following. So we can use our definition of theta L. It's 1 over negative I to the L, integral from negative 1 to 1, d mu over 2, PL of mu times theta. We can use the fact that if I integrate one of these Legendre functions over mu, from negative 1 to 1, I get 0. And then we can use the definition of a special function that plays a very important role called the spherical Bessel function. So we have k eta minus eta last scattering. This is defined as negative I to the L, the integral from negative 1 to 1, d mu over 2, PL of mu, e to the ik mu, eta minus eta last scattering. So the spherical Bessel function is basically what tells us how to project plane waves onto a sphere. So using this and doing just a little bit of algebra, you'll find that theta L is simply equal to theta L at any time eta
is theta naught at last scattering plus psi at last scattering times this spherical Bessel function. That's it, okay? So this tells us what the temperature anisotropies in the CMB today, if we evaluate eta as eta now, are in terms of what we know about the temperature distribution function and the gravitational potential at last scattering. So can anyone tell me why this appears here in that particular combination, just a physical reason? So what's theta naught at last scattering? So that's the intrinsic temperature, right? So this just tells me what is the temperature at different points, at different physical points at last scattering, right? And what's psi? That's a gravitational potential, right? So the temperature anisotropy I see today is going to be due not only to the intrinsic difference in temperature that I see at different places, but it's also going to depend on the gravitational potential, because these photons are redshifting as they're either climbing out of or falling into different gravitational potentials. So the thing that I see is made up both of some intrinsic delta T over T, but it's also due to gravitational redshift. So in fact, maybe it pays to have a picture here. So let's say I'm here, and I'm looking back in time. Okay, so this here is a piece of the surface of last scattering. So this is eta last scattering. This is eta now. Okay. And I'm plotting eta, and then these are two spatial directions, x and y. Okay. So I'm looking back. Here is the past light cone, my past light cone, and here is where it intersects the surface of last scattering. Right? So let's say I had some intrinsic variation in the temperature that I can see. So I have these intrinsic variations in the temperature, and those look different in different directions, right? So here it looks hot if I look in that direction, here it looks cold if I look in that direction, here it looks hot, etc. That's the intrinsic temperature, but wherever I have an overdensity of photons, remember that's correlated with having a gravitational potential. So I have to take into account the fact that when these photons come to me from here, they're going to redshift a little bit, right? Because they're having to fall out of this gravitational potential on their way. So it's not just the intrinsic part of the CMB I see, it's the intrinsic part plus this gravitational redshift. So now let's ask, how big are these relative contributions, given the fact that we have some information about what things look like at last scattering? So if we look at these largest scales again, so on the largest scales, when these fluctuations are all superhorizon at the time of last scattering, then we've got some information about how the potential evolves. So phi, I guess here we should also say that on these largest scales, phi is basically equal to negative psi. That came about because on the largest scales, the gradient term doesn't matter, and that second Einstein equation tells us that that these two potentials should be equal and opposite. So what we know is that on these super horizon very large scales, if I start out with some theta naught, then it's constant deep in the radiation era. And if you play around, what you'll find in your homework is that as you go through matter radiation equality, you basically just change phi by a factor of 9/10. And on large scales, that's universal. You always get 9/10. So you shift this by 9/10. Okay, so we know how, and then here is, we'll say, eta last scattering. So that's where we want to look at phi. So we have some set of equations that we wrote down, which can tell us, given how phi and how phi behaves, we can figure out how the dark matter over density and the photon field changes. So in this limit where we're looking at large scales, we get theta naught dot equals negative phi dot. And then that is just, well, gotten from here. So we assume that phi is negative psi. And what that means is that theta naught is just going to be equal to negative phi plus a constant. So all I've done is just integrated both sides of this equation. So I'll get that theta is negative phi plus constant. And I know that theta naught from my initial condition, as eta goes to 0, had better be equal to phi naught over 2 that we showed yesterday. And that implies that this constant had better be equal to 3 phi naught over 2. Yeah, so, so it's a constant when you're deep in the radiation era. Uh-huh. And then you go through matter radiation equality and it's no longer going to be a constant. And that's because we've now changed Hubble. So let's go back to our equations. We didn't write down Einstein's equation, did we? But that one told us that phi dot, so there was this a dot 3, a dot over a, phi dot minus, I think it was a dot over a psi, I believe that's what it looked like. And then we had some stuff on the right-hand side, which went like 4 pi g, and then some densities here. So we had matter, radiation, etc. So from this equation, we're going to get time evolution of the potentials whenever we have change in the scale factor. Okay. So now scale factor has changed from that dominated by radiation to that dominated by matter. And that's going to give rise to this evolution of the potential. And you can just actually do it. Just set k to 0 in that Mathematica notebook you can get off of the wiki. And you'll find that phi will decrease by exactly a factor of 9/10. You could show that analytically by solving these equations as well. It's not that hard, but you get 9/10. Okay, so let me just finish one thing before I let you go. So that's the equation we get for theta. And so if we evaluate that at the time of last scattering, so theta naught at the time of last scattering is going to be, as we have up there, negative phi plus negative phi at last scattering plus 3/2 the initial value of phi. And this is just 9/10 times the initial value of phi. So here I'll just get that, actually let's do it the other way. So let's write this in terms of phi at last scattering. Sorry about that. So that's 10 over 9 phi at last scattering. Okay, and this will just be 2/3 times phi at last scattering. So that's theta naught as it relates to phi at the time of last scattering. And psi is negative theta, right? So that means that, in fact, theta L at last scattering is equal to this 2/3 phi at last scattering minus phi at last scattering times this spherical Bessel function. And this, of course, is just negative 1/3 phi at last scattering. So the intrinsic variation in the temperature is actually smaller than the gravitational redshift that you incur. So a spot that if I was sitting around at last scattering was hotter than the surroundings, to me, now would actually look colder because the gravitational redshift more than compensates for this initial variation in the temperature. And this formula here is known as the Sachs-Wolfe equation. And this basically tells me everything I need to know about the CMB on the largest scales. It's just, I map my different moments of the temperature onto the value of phi at last scattering. Okay? And that's all I need to know. So any questions before we break for the day? And then tomorrow we're going to talk about the power spectrum. And we'll come back to these acoustic oscillations and how they show up as the wiggles in the power spectrum. Okay, if there's no questions, then see you tomorrow.